Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances, the podcast where we take you down the rabbit hole into the fantastic world of the strange, the paranormal, and the unknown. I'm Morgan Knudsen.
And I am Mike Brown. It's time to dim the lights and settle in. Come along with us on this week's adventure.
It's a good adventure.
It is a good adventure. Yeah. And we have somebody who's an interesting, cool person and another Canuck.
Yes, which doesn't happen very often.
No, Jason Hewlett. Yeah, he is one of the founders of the Canadian Paranormal Society.
Yeah, and his work in both the paranormal realm and the cryptozoology realm is pretty cool. And today, which I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while, we're talking about a lake monster that doesn't really get talked about a whole lot, which is Ogopogo.
Well, you and I have talked about Ogopogo a lot because we're Canadian and we live in the West.
Yes, he's well known around here, but not so much in other parts of the world. And I think the cool thing about Ogopogo specifically is not just the idea that, you know, he's this great big hulking physical lake monster that nobody's caught, but rather the spirituality and the legend and lore that goes around his story. It's very deep.
Oh, aren't you punny? A lake monster that's very deep.
Hey, we're taking a deep dive here.
Oh, boy.
The jokes don't get better, but there are more of them.
No, yeah, exactly.
But this is so interesting, and I'm excited about this story because many times these types of creatures, they do get slotted into that dynamic of, well, this is either physical or it's non-physical, and that's it.
Yeah.
And we know from many a show that those two categories blur together real well. And this is one of those stories, which I think is so impactful for the people around the lake, for Canadian lore, and for our understanding of consciousness.
Exactly. So let's go ahead and talk to Jason Hewlett, and he'll let us know about some cursed waters and the creature of Lake Okanagan.
Let's go. You guys ready? I'm ready to go if you guys are ready to go.
Sure. Yeah.
I was born ready, I guess.
Your enthusiasm is underwhelming, Mike.
Oh, boy.
Say it with feeling, Mike. Say it with feeling.
I should just put up an icon of Eeyore for my...
That's awesome.
He's not really like this, Jason, I'm telling you.
I'm just having fun.
It's the morning.
Yep. Oh, my God. Only had one cup of coffee, so that's probably what the problem is. I need about 40 more.
Yeah, I hear you. I just poured myself another one before coming downstairs because it's just been, my kid's been sick, so it's been like broken sleeps and for the last few days. It's just like, ugh.
You're in Kamloops, right?
Yep. Yes, I am.
Yeah. And that's a hot spot for Bigfoot, et cetera, et cetera.
It is actually. I didn't know that growing up until I kind of got later in. It's like, oh, wow, these guys are supposed to be everywhere around here, right? So it's been an interesting discovery. Kamloops has actually got a lot of weird stuff associated with it, I'm learning. Especially when you bring in indigenous belief systems.
Right.
Which makes it clear. And of course, we're close to Kelowna as well, right? Of course, where there's Ogopogo and things like that. But I guess there's something here that in the land that doesn't like people to leave. Because I've tried leaving numerous times and I'll move away for a year or two and I always come back. And it seems to happen to everybody I've met. They just end up back in Kamloops. And I talked to a buddy of mine, Chris Bowes, who's an indigenous artist and storyteller. And he's just like, yeah, man, there's something here. It does not like, if you're from Kamloops, you are always drawn back for some reason. So I don't know.
Oh, well, that's terrifying. Okay, well, we have to get into that today.
I want to get out.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Jason.
How would I describe myself? I'm someone with a... I was a journalist for 10 years, like a crime reporter, with a background in film studies, which I got into film kind of when I... in the 90s when, you know, it was impossible to make anything because it all cost so much money because everything was done on film. But I've also had a lifelong interest in the paranormal, and I've sort of in the last 5 years have found kind of my passion for like ghost hunting and paranormal investigation merging with my journalism background and my passion for film. And I'm the co-founder of the Canadian Paranormal Society. We have a web series called We Want to Believe, where we document our investigations. And I've also written full four books now, three of which have come out, and the fourth one, which is coming out later this year from Small Town Monsters Publishing, which is about Ogopogo.
Wow, cool.
And that ties into a documentary I made with Eli Watson of Small Town Monsters that's coming out later this year called Cursed Waters, Creature of Lake Okanagan. And so that's kind of me in a nutshell circa right now 2024 sort of thing.
I think it's so exciting. I Mike and I have talked about this before, where we've wanted to do a show about Ogopogo because you don't hear a lot about Ogopogo, and I think the mystery around this particular lake monster is pretty unique compared to some of the other ones. So for people who don't know who Ogopogo is, what is it? Let people know what it is.
Well, and that's something when I kind of started researching the book that I had one idea of what Ogopogo was. And by the time I finished the book and we finished the documentary, it had changed quite a bit. which is I found fascinating because on the one hand, Ogopogo is like a lake monster in Lake Okanagan. And it's you know, between depending on what you hear, it's like 25 to 60 feet long, kind of serpentine, with like the head of either a horse or dragon, body of a snake, tail of a whale, you know, and these little sort of nodules slash horns, some people describe as deer horns. And it's been spotted. It's actually one of the more documented lake monsters out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a huge tourism draw for the city of Kelowna. You know, Ogopogo, you can get Ogopogo stuffies. There's Ogopogo is in children's books. It's like on their mugs and shirts and hats and everything like that. So that's the one side of it. And people have been drawn from all over the world to track down Ogopogo, wanting to find evidence that this creature exists. But what I learned while working on the book is that it has a strong tie to sort of First Nations beliefs. And it's not a monster at all. It is a spirit of the lake. I'm going to mangle the pronunciation, but it's like Nahaitu, I think is the actual indigenous name for it. And it's there all the time. Like they say, if you really want to catch Ogopogo, go down with a cup, get a cup of water out of the lake and you've got Ogopogo. Cause it is the lake itself. And it's sort of when I have a hard time with lake monsters because someone that approaches things from a more scientific angle, you know, how can something like that or a species live in a limited body of water and you not see it more often, not have carcasses wash up, but taking it from the more spiritual side of things, I kind of have an easier time accepting it and believing in it because, you know, I hunt ghosts. So I already believe that things can have a spiritual form anyways that make itself known kind of when they want to. So I kind of look at, I can see the both sides of the story, and I really like the indigenous belief system when it comes to this because you can tie that into Sasquatch, like paranormal Sasquatch encounters, etc. So I don't know if I've done a great job explaining what Ogopogo is, but that's sort of where I'm at with the story of Ogopogo right now.
I'm so excited by your explanation, actually, because this is exactly what Mike and I have been talking about over the last number of episodes in the show, is that there, and we talked to Ron Moorhead and Travis Watson and a bunch of other people about the Sasquatch side of this and this sort of continuum that is a sort of this non-physical to physical continuum, rather than it being, oh, something has to be physical and has to be non-physical, that everything is kind of this blend of both. And so I think the First Nations explanation on a lot of this phenomenon has to be taken into account. It makes sense to me, because when we even look at ourselves, we see this this blend of physical and non-physical just within humans and animals and what we see in our environment. We're coming to understand this stuff. And so I find it really interesting that we can extend this now to the phenomenon of Ogopogo, which is, again, another topic where people are in that debate of, well, you know, it must be this physical creature. Well, how does the physical creature get here? So I find this really interesting.
That sort of was my take too, because I mean, yeah, on the physical side, people say that, you know, oh, well, there's, it lives at Rattlesnake Island, which the indigenous people believe too, but they come up with this, like, well, there's this network of tunnels underneath it, right? Mm-hmm. And these tunnels connect like to different lakes, you know, so it becomes, there's almost like creating this elaborate explanation to explain this flesh and blood thing, why you don't see it so much. Whereas kind of the answer is sort of right there. If you're willing to look at the spiritual side of things, it's there all the time. If you see it, you're really lucky because it's actually wanting to show itself to you. So you shouldn't waste time trying to take photographs and pictures. You should just enjoy the moment that you're actually seeing this thing. But otherwise, it's there. And, you know, when the water gets choppy, that's because it's angry or upset. Or when the sun sort of shimmers across it, that's when it's happy. And you just kind of got to take more of an open-minded approach to, I think, this phenomenon. And I think as a society, we're starting to get that way when it comes to the paranormal. There's a desire for a more spiritual connection, I think.
Especially with what's going on in the world right now. We all need a little bit of relief in that regard.
Exactly.
I'm loving this conversation and how it's gone exactly where I was thinking it was going to go right at the beginning. So I'm really excited about this. And I noticed too, you know, as I was going back in the dates of Ogopogo history, is that oftentimes there was even misunderstandings about the history of Ogopogo as well, that this was a creature that demanded sacrifice, and that anybody who rejected nature, whichever, was denying existence of some kind of a demon. And that there was a settler in 1855, John McDougall, that claimed that his horses were like sucked down into the water and nearly died. And it wasn't until a fellow by the name of Pat Raphael of the West Bank First Nations came out and said this was absolutely and utterly wrong, that this was a miscommunication between Canada's early European settlers and the Okanagan people. So that there's even mistranslations about things like this, that maybe we want to demonize but have nothing to do with that, you know, a horrible history at all.
Well, exactly. And I mean, with the McDougall story, I mean, if you talk to West Bank's First Nations, he apparently, like, you know, they said he was like a player of the time, and he made lots of babies with lots of indigenous people. And he did disrespect, you know, the whole idea of Ogopogo. And so, you know, or when he was trying to cross the lake, yeah, maybe he paid the price for it. Or maybe the horses just got caught in an undercurrent and were pulled under, right? Like, there's lots of ways you can look at that. But There's a tradition, and it extends to Sasquatch as well, that you do make sort of an offering when you go into the woods, right, to guarantee safe travel. But it's not like a sacrifice or anything, and it's not like huge carcasses of meat. Like, it's maybe a bit of tobacco or a little bit of fruit, or, like, you know, some Sasquatch prefer, like, just leave a certain rock for it, right? It's just more paying respect than anything else. But when they see, like, even say a little chunk of meat put out to an alleged lake monster, like, Western culture blows out of proportion, that you're sacrificing, you know, animals to this demon, which is not the case. I think that we have a tendency in Western society to do that a lot anyways, to jump to conclusions and take stories and blow them out of proportion. So that's, I think that's partly where that comes from.
Yeah, and to make things more horrific than they are. Like, and I mean, and the West is so famous for that specifically. I mean, we see it in our TV shows, and we see, they'll take something that is, you know, predominantly positive and then manage to warp it into something that's just this horrific thing and whatnot. And I mean, there are throughout these various legends and things like that, no matter where you go. I mean, there are some horrific stories. Like, you look at stories like the Wendigo and things like that, and they're terrifying, but this is one of those that absolutely doesn't need to be. And everything that I've seen in and of the history of the Ogopogo is something that is very protective, is nurturing of the land. And like you say, it goes into other traditions like Sasquatch and even Yeti. Like, the Sherpa believe that it is, you know, the god of the mountains. It's there to nurture and protect these things. So, I mean, it makes sense to me that you've got something you know, that we really have to put down our fear and stop demonizing things that we just don't understand.
I agree 100%. I wonder how much of that maybe does tie into, our religious background in the West, right? Like, if it's not part of like Catholicism or Protestantism, it's bad and it's wrong and it's evil and people aren't seeing ghosts. It's all demon, you know, demon. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that ties into it too. It's like sort of an unwillingness to be open-minded about other belief systems.
Right.
Yeah. And it's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy, right? Like, I mean, it doesn't take any thinking to turn around and say that's just evil and I don't want anything to do with it. Like, that takes zero work. You know, and so I kind of wonder about that as well. And I mean, and we see the same thing in the sort of the more militant guerrilla skeptics, not all skeptics, but the very militant guerrilla skeptics who, immediately when something's presented that requires deconstruction of an idea, immediately that's the hammer comes down and it's nope, that's either a fake or it's wrong or, in the religious sense, it's evil. So we kind of see that. So it's interesting that, you know, we again see it throughout this story as well. But Ogopogo, because very strange name. Can we talk a little bit about the name? Where did this come from? Because it's a quirky name compared to something like Loch Ness Monster.
Well, Ogopogo was actually, it came from a song called The Funny Foxtrot. And it was actually, it was like played sort of in the dance halls of Vernon. And and that's literally where it started, actually. It was kind of cool because Eli found the actual song and it's in our documentary, which I think is fantastic. And when you listen to it, yeah, it's like, you know, it's the whole, it tells the story of the Ogopogo and, you know, the body of a serpent, kind of like I said earlier. And then that, the name became copyrighted by the village of Vernon. And they had it until recently, actually, where they actually let the copyright go. And I think West Bank First Nations has actually picked it up since then, if I'm not mistaken. So it's literally a made up name. It has nothing to do with the actual original stories about the creature in the lake or the spirit of the lake. And so even that speaks to the kind of, it's a real case of cultural misappropriation. So like Tourism Kelowna is using this to market Kelowna and all this merchandise, which I've been guilty of buying for my son, etc. But it's become a bit of a place of contention with the indigenous people as well. Like, they say that's fine and everything, but don't misrepresent the two almost. Like, they're two totally separate things in reality.
That's really interesting. I was just reading, I put down some notes here and just reading that, originally the historians that talk about it, specifically Mark Orkin, the creature received its name on a night in 1924 when the strains of an English music hall song, exactly like what you said, were first heard in the city of Vernon. And some of the lines for the song that some of the people out there might recognize, because I definitely recognize, is his mother was an earwig, his father was a whale, a little bit of head and hardly any tail, and Ogopogo was his name. And I think a lot of people in the West grew up with that song. I remember that song.
Totally.
Yeah, and Orkin goes on to talk about that a somewhat different form of the song appeared in the Vancouver province in 1912 and again in August 24th, 1926. And according to the DC, the name was first applied in 1912. So this goes back quite a ways and probably a lot further back in the First Nations traditions, I'm guessing.
Way back. It's been there. Nahahisu has been there since like the dawn of time, right? As long as there's been people there, there's been the spirit of the lake. It was probably even precedes like, you know, people. The stories have been told for hundreds of years, but it's as soon as like MacDougall and company show up that they start seeing things and having experiences that they, I think, just naturally, it could have been completely unrelated, but they started tying it into this story of the spirit of the lake. And to them, of course, it became a demon because they didn't understand it and it scared them and things like that, like we were talking about earlier. So it's been there forever. And this Ogopogo creation is very, like, within the last 100 years, it's been around. But it's amazing how quickly the Ogopogo story has sort of overtaken the historical side of things. And I think that's why a lot of indigenous people are hesitant to talk about their belief systems, because we just take it and turn it into something else entirely or don't respect it.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. So let's get into a few sightings here, because there's been a lot of sightings over the years. What are people seeing when they see this critter?
They're all very similar. They all describe, and there's the statue, Peter Sloan's statue, that's in the main park in Kelowna at the waterfront. And that's basically what they're seeing, which I think is interesting. But a lot of it, like, you know, there's the Art Folden's film, the Folden film from 1968, which is like the first real bit of footage captured of what they believe is the monster. And that was off of Highway 97. And it showed something of, like, you know, very long, shot on 8mm camera that's about 60 feet. Larry Thal also filmed it like a few years later, the home movie camera. And it's all very similar to the undulating serpentine, you know, up and down motion in the water. The most recent was Dale Hatcher and Colleen Hansen. That was the picture that kind of went a bit viral in October of 2022. They actually took a picture of something in the water, and people have said it's like it's a dog or it's a duck or it's a, you know, decomposing crawfish. But if you really look at that picture, and Eli and I went out to the exact spot, if it's a dog, I think it probably drowned because it was so far out, right? But it looks like if you put that picture up to the next to the head of the statue, it looks like very much similar. And to hear them describe it, it was motionless in the water. It was just sitting there, and it looked like it had a neck that just went very deep down. It wasn't bobbing up and down. It was just very quietly there looking at them as they went by in their sailboat. And the only reason they went to the media with it is because they weren't sure what it was, and they were worried that it could have been a boating hazard. You know what I mean? And they're trying to find out. So, you know, people have said, oh, they put their picture out for money. It's like, no, that's not what they wanted. When we talk to them, they're very genuine about what they saw in the water. That's the most recent. I mean, there's footage that's ended up, I remember, on Unsolved Mysteries back in, like, the late 80s, and it was actually a beaver. You know, I think what makes Ogopogo stand out is there's been more than one sighting. I think the Thal sighting was one where there's many people saw it at once. Not just one person, but you're having, like, you know, like, I think even as much as a dozen at a time have seen it, reported seeing it in the water. There's been people who have water skied and seen it in the water. There's been a swimmer who tried, you know, was swimming, doing like a marathon swim in the lake, which said he thought he saw like several small ones following him or swimming alongside him. Like, people have been seeing this a lot, and, you know, for as long as people have been there. And I mean, of course, Susan Allison's was the first real sighting of it. Yeah, where she actually documented it. There's been a bit of a debate of whether it was her or her husband, but regardless, it's in her journal that it was seen. And it's they're describing the same thing. It's not like one person thinks they're seeing a plesiosaur or whatnot. They're describing the exact same thing, just to varying lengths. And where Susan Allison lived, like, the house currently exists at Quail's Gate Winery. They've left it standing, and they're using it as kind of like an artist studio, where if you stand there and look towards the lake and you remove like all the winery stuff, you'd get a really good view of something down in that body of water.
Sure.
So that's interesting.
Some people think it's something a little more earthly too. Like, I've heard the giant sturgeon hypothesis about this.
Yeah, and Bill Stesiak, who's kind of, he runs sort of, he's like the legend hunter. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of press. He's been on, what was that show? Monster Quest and stuff. He has a website like ogopogoquest.com where he catalogs all these sightings. He says that the sturgeon theory doesn't work because there apparently are no sturgeon in Lake Okanagan.
There you go.
Right? So, and he would know. Like, he's been there for a long time looking for this.
Oftentimes the misidentification label gets thrown out, get out there by the skeptics and things like that very, very quickly. And I always struggle with that because, I mean, yes, misidentification is possible. I mean, our minds do play tricks on us. They do make things up. But the one thing that I've noticed is that has become a very strict go-to excuse. Mm-hmm. And people, when people see something paranormal or they see something, you know, cryptid-like or whatever, I think what many of these naysayers don't understand is that typically our brains don't go to, look, that's a Sasquatch, or look, that's a sea monster. Most of the time, the human brain tries to slot it into something that we understand. Like, and I've been in this position by myself, and I'll give you guys a little bit of an example here, where I was out with a couple of investigators right here in the city of Edmonton. And we were in this extremely wooded area. There's nobody around. And we were next to sort of this old bike trail. And it was the middle of the night. Nobody's on it. And we were looking at electromagnetic phenomenon in this one area. And we kind of have a policy, especially if we're in the dark or anything like that, where you don't, you know, boot your camera up and start taking pictures without saying flash, because you can literally blind somebody. Like, mm-hmm. you just knock these people out. And so we were out there and we looked through the trees to our right and we saw this bright light. And I mean, it was like, if you can imagine like an LED bright white light flashlight was what it looked like. It was so blinding. And immediately our brains went to somebody's on a bike. And that's sort of where our brains went, and we kind of ignored it and we were focused on what we were doing, and we saw it like moving along at a pretty steady pace. And it, as it should have rounded the corner onto the adjacent path that we were on, we're walking up the path. We could hear footsteps coming down where that light was, coming down around the corner, and they were clear as a bell, and we thought, okay, somebody's got a light. They're coming down around the path. We looked up, and A, nobody was there. B, there's this great big bright light that's just there. There was nothing attached to this thing, and it came around the corner, and it disappeared. Not one of us immediately, you know, yanked our cameras out, and we're like, oh my God, it's this. Our brain spent our entire experience with that going, okay, it's got to be a person on a bike. No, it's a person walking. Oh, it's a person must have a flashlight. And so your brain doesn't automatically go to that. So it bugs me often when people immediately sort of throw that excuse out there that it's like, this is a misidentification. And that's what everybody's seeing that, because our brains just don't work like that.
No, it's very, I mean, I've had that happen. You know, you described something that I experienced. We had a place at Little Shuswap Lake, which is about, you know, an hour east of where I live right now. I remember being out there one night with a buddy of mine and I, and there was this light, the same kind of thing, a light that was suddenly on the deck and it was moving back and forth on the deck. And we're like, oh, it's just traffic across the lake. You know what I mean? Because there's a highway across the lake. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, half hour later, it's like, that was too big to be a car across the lake. You know what I mean? But yeah, we immediately jumped on that. It's got to be that. Or someone walking on the deck with a flashlight, even though there's no footsteps and it's a wooden deck, you'd have heard footsteps. So we are very quick in our minds to come up with the most logical explanation for things that's not paranormal. And I think skeptics can latch onto that. I think there's sometimes, though, people, I think it can work both ways a bit. Like, there's a gentleman I talked to named Daniel Loxton I interviewed for the book, and he's written for Skeptical Inquirer and stuff. And he's like the nicest skeptic I've met, because he loves these stories and wants them to be true. And he argues that sometimes people will misidentify things as a lake monster or a ghost because they're aware that the story is there to begin with. And they're going in with that preconceived notion. So I can kind of agree that, like, with him on that. Like, I know as an investigator, we go into locations that are supposed to be haunted, like a home or a historical site. And we have to be really careful that when something weird happens, we don't just assume it's paranormal. We have to try to almost debunk it first. And if we can't debunk it, then we accept the paranormal side of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's how to reduce confirmation bias. I mean, everybody wants to confirm that their hypothesis is the true one. So,
right?
So, yeah, it's absolutely essential for us to look at other things as well. The things that we don't like, especially.
Exactly. And I think as investigators, like, if you say then you've confirmed one thing at a location is haunted, you don't want to then just assume everything else that happens that night or over the course of your investigations is paranormal as well. You almost got to go on a case-by-case basis with each little bit of potential evidence, you know. And I think that's how you come up with real evidence in this field, right? I think you've got to be very Occam's razor-ish with everything that happens. and I think that's when you have good luck.
Well, and especially with things like lake monsters, because when you get creatures like this where, I mean, the water is constantly in motion, you know, our visibility isn't great. I mean, we can't see to the bottom. You know, outside investigations, especially like this, I think bring on a whole other element of difficulty, because you don't have a controlled set environment. You know, everything's moving, everything's shifting, you know, right even down to the depth of the water, depending on, you know, hot day, cold day. So, I mean, there's a lot with the environment that makes these things quite difficult too, which is something that I think factors into cases like this, and especially the spiritual side. Mike and I were talking about this just recently, where I think we've got an elephant that we're seeing a tiny little piece of, and we're trying to figure out how to eat the elephant. And we don't know, because we can't even see the fact that it's an elephant. We're trying to figure out this tiny little piece, and then we got to figure out how to digest it. And it's really, really tricky. But what investigations do you know that have been done into the lake, and what's been found?
Well, there was Bill Stasiuk's done two of them, where he even partnered up. I believe it was with like a crew from Japan, where they did. I'm just trying to find it because I had to bring up my notes.
Yeah, no,
sorry,
go for
just
it.
Give me
go
a second here, so I get it right. Because he sort of was inspired by seeing it while driving across, the floating bridge in Lake Okanagan. And he kind of dedicated his life to looking for Ogopogo. But he went out actually with Monster Quest looking for proof of Ogopogo. And they focus a lot around Rattlesnake Island. And they found, that's where they found like what could possibly be like those caves down there. Like they had a diver try to go into it and said that there was something, it felt like some kind of current in these caves. And they used also like they used sonar equipment as well. And they picked up like a sonar ping of something pretty large.
Cool.
Down in the water that they couldn't really, confirm, but lasted for 35 seconds. And then the object moved away. Which led to the second, sorry, that was the first expedition. And the second expedition, that's when they sort of focused more on Rattlesnake Island and Seclusion Bay. And they believed that they found the cave thing. Sorry, my brain got a little jumbled up there. Probably wasn't okay. This morning.
No problem.
Those have been kind of the two biggest, most recent expeditions. But John Kirk has spent a lot of time at the lake as well. And he was out on a boat. And they actually found what they believe. It was like this weird oily kind of residue in the water that had bits of like shrimp and other aquatic life in it. Mm-hmm. They felt looked like regurgitated food, for lack of a better word. And they did gather a sample of that, but they admit that when they went back to UBC, there wasn't a proper tracking of the material and it eventually was lost. So they were kind of like, they thought that was very unfortunate because they could have used there could have been DNA evidence in there that could have supported some kind of life that would have eaten whatever this mass was. Those have been the really big expeditions. So it hasn't been quite as well hit as, say, Loch Ness, where that Loch Ness has been like dozens of times, I believe, even most recently when, Ken Gearhard was there on a bit of an expedition. But it's been a while since there's been a really big expedition, I believe, on Lake Okanagan. I think Stasiuk's were kind of the last two big ones, and that was the early 2000s. So we're already going back 20-some-odd years.
Oh, well, maybe we need a new one.
Well, I'm right? Just thinking that, and I want to go. I will be there in a heartbeat. It's just a quick drive for me.
Where are you, Mike?
I'm in Langley.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's nothing. Yeah. It's like 3 hours tops, yeah. I believe, right?
Exactly. So if there's anything ever going on, let me know, and I'll be there with all kinds of crazy camera gear and stuff.
Oh, you and me both, I'd fly out for that.
Yep.
It's like Eli and I spent a lot of time on the water filming the documentary. Like we went out, like I said, we went out with Colleen and Dale, and then we went out with Bill Stasiuk to Rattlesnake Island, and we brought Coralie Miller and Kate Ault of West Bank First Nations with us to the island. And looked around, and we shot some footage and stuff like that. Like we didn't really, the whole time we were out there, we didn't really see anything that we could purport to be even a possible lake monster sighting. The day we went, both days though were very pleasant days. So, I mean, if you believe in the spirit of the lake, Nahahitu was very happy with us those days. Right. And we did our offering when we went out to make sure. So, to be a part of a bigger expedition, I think would be great. When we talked with John Kirk about it, it's almost, and he brings up a really valid point, and I'm sure you guys have found this with paranormal investigations. When you actively go looking quite often, that's when you find nothing. It's when you're just sort of haphazardly just around that stuff happens, or when you've put all your equipment away, that this ghost appears or something like that. So I think a really good approach is just to spend a lot more time around the lake, even just hanging out, going for a swim, and then in hope that something will kind of casually happen, and just have your kind of camera at the ready. It's when you've set up like 50 cameras near Rattlesnake Island for 4 days that you're probably not going to have anything happen remotely Ogopogo-ish.
Stephanie and I, when she was still alive, when we would go out early on, this was 20 plus years ago now, we would go out, you know, when we were first really, really taking this on as a career. And it was exactly like that. I mean, we would, you know, you'd go out and you'd, you know, have all the cameras and sensors and everything, and nothing would go on. And we really learned very, very quickly that in order to tap into this phenomenon, whether it be in the field of, you know, these sort of spirits, lake monsters, this kind of a thing, or whether you're dealing with hauntings or anything like that, you have to be tuned in, tapped in, turned on, as Abraham Hicks would say, and present. You have to be present in the moment. And it's like, as soon as you start going into these situations and you're looking, you're giving off the, I guess, the attraction point that you, that it's not there because you're looking for it. And as soon as you let that go, as soon as you're able to just be present in the moment and hold no expectations, suddenly things start to manifest and to show up. And I found that exact thing that you're talking about, Jason, absolutely consistently through this. When we had Ron Moorhead on talking about Nantinuk in Portlock, and he was saying the exact same thing, where he was like, the best expeditions that he's had going out to wherever has been to go out and sit and be present and just, and allow this stuff to manifest. And all of a sudden, you know, you're having this experience. But chances are, if you know you've got a million cameras pulled out, in my experience, you're not going to see a damn thing.
Yeah, and I think that's, we found that even with art, with doing We Want to Believe, like we have captured stuff on camera, but it's because we're just simply filming us investigating. We're not like trying to stage, you know, you right. know what I mean? Like we're yep. not intentionally looking for something. Mm-hmm. And if we have nothing happen in an investigation and it becomes an episode, then it's the episode where nothing happens. And I think that's the best way to document this material too. Like I always get on this tangent. I have a big problem with a lot of the reality paranormal shows.
Right. Yeah.
Cause they have stuff happen all the time and that's impossible.
Yeah, like, it, you know, it really to the degree is, that yeah.
these things happen. So yeah, I think that's just the best approach to take. Even when we went looking for Bigfoot as an example, we went with a guy who'd been to the same lake up in the Bonaparte Plateau, and he's had, every time he'd go to this one end of the lake on his fishing trips, he'd hear these knocks, these wood knocks, these three wood knocks.
Mm-hmm.
For 20 years. And so we went up with them. And of course, we go to that end of the lake and nothing happens. We even go to shore and nothing happens. But when we get back, our colleague Sean, who stayed behind, said, yeah, I heard wood knocks coming from over here, the complete opposite side of the lake.
Hmm.
Right? Like a little bit of misdirection, I think, goes on too. I think this stuff, the paranormal, becomes very aware too of when we're looking for it. And it doesn't always want to be caught on camera. It likes to play a game with us.
Well, it's like that whole idea of, I hate to bring this up, but the law of attraction, like whatever you are after is what you'll receive. So if you're in the idea yeah. of, I want to see this, I want to see this, you'll get nothing more than wanting to see this.
100%. 100%.
People negate that as, you know, well, that's just woo-woo thinking. But it isn't. That it's the groundwork of parapsychology, is that we do create our reality. That is how it works. That's a study of parapsychology, is how our mind interacts with the world around us and how our perception interacts with the world around us and how things change. You know, and there's the people out there, the colleagues that I have in academia and beyond that study this in the labs. And that is how this works. I mean, it's in quantum physics terms, it's called the observer effect. You know, it's like you do get what you expect to see, whether that be what you want or not is another question. But that level of allowing, and that really, really does make a difference on what it is that you're observing. And there was a study done, this is a little bit unrelated, but directly related to what we're talking about. There was a study done a number of years ago, and the name of the fellow escapes me at the moment, but basically the idea was he wanted to test the mindset of people who believed that they were just genuinely lucky and full of abundance versus the people who weren't. And what he did was he sort of had a call put out for people to come, a group of people to come and join him at this townhome where this so-called experiment was going to happen. But what he did was he put money underneath, like sort of sticking out from underneath the doormat in front of the door. And what was so fascinating was that every single person that believed that they were abundant found it and saw it mm-hmm. and picked it up. Not one person that were like pessimistic and, I'm unlucky and nothing good happens for me and so on and so forth. Not one single person saw it. And what became the question on the table was, for the people that didn't see it, was it even there? Huh. Was it even there? And so it opened up a whole plethora of questions. But I think that same thing can be applied to something like that. How open are you? I mean, we see it in the Ganzfeld experiments when people are, looking at remote viewing and receiving images and things like that. The people who are not open and are not able to quiet their minds and so on and so forth don't do well statistically.
I would have found the money, just so you know. I would have been one of those ones that found the money. I have thousands of examples of that kind of stuff in my life, countless. It's crazy.
Yeah. And same here. Like, I mean, I just, things just line up. But I think, again, I mean, you look at the mindset of like the three of us, and that makes sense to me. So it's a really, really interesting, but I think that understanding applies to things like Ogopogo, applies to things like Sasquatch. I mean, you hear about hunters that are out there and they're just hanging out in their tree stands and they're just chilling out. Like, that's their peaceful place. And all of a sudden, bam, they see this thing, or they're hiking or, whatever the situation may be. But they're in that state of allowing. And in hauntings, it's the same. You have paranormal experience. Most people say, well, I was washing the dishes at my kitchen sink and something showed up. And they were doing something very mundane where they can let their mind go. So it's like, I think in Ogopogo, I mean, here you've got, this beautiful, beautiful lake. You're out on your boat. You're hanging out. You're letting your mind go and whatever. And bam, something shows up that you're like, what is this? So, I mean, to me, this fits into everything that we've been learning about this phenomenon.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because when I went into writing the book and doing the documentary, I was pretty skeptical of the whole lake monster thing. But when we met with Colleen and Dale, Colleen was mentioning that the day that they went out on the boat and saw the thing in the water, potentially Ogopogo, is Colleen's mother, I believe it was her mother, had recently passed away. And so she was quite, down and depressed, and she'd sort of put it out there to the universe or to God or however you want to describe it, that she just wanted to be distracted sort of from her grief that day. And lo and behold, on that trip, they saw the thing in the water. Mm-hmm. And took that picture.
Wow.
Right. And so that she sees it as that was sort of the universe giving her something amazing to focus on to sort of distract her from where she was emotionally going into that. And that really struck a chord with me. It was almost like this gift. You know what I mean?
Sure.
To see that and have something wondrous happen during a time that was otherwise quite, quite sad. And that kind of, that really got me thinking that there's more to this, right? Like you say, you're in this, every time I've had sort of a paranormal experience, it's generally been in in an open state of mind or in a place that I'm very comfortable with, et cetera. Obviously you go into an investigations, you have stuff happen too, but that's when you're very much allowing yourself to dial into these. But even at my house, I've had stuff happen here where I'm just totally relaxed and something happens that just totally seems very odd and unusual.
Mm. Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, if something's going to happen in my place, because I there's a lot of stuff that's happened over the years in my little apartment, but it's been really interesting because it's usually during a time where I don't know, I'm like, cuddling with Galen on the bed, or I'm sometimes it's when I'm not even in the room. I'll hear something go on out in the living room. I mean, we had an interesting experience. This has happened a number of times now. My kitchen table is this really great big heavy wood kitchen table. You need like four people to move this thing. And there's been a number of times where, I've come out of a bedroom, or like my mom's been here and she's come and gone and looked at the table and said, has the table moved like 2 feet? And I'll come out and be like, what do you mean? And we look at the table and no joke, this massive wooden table has moved like a foot to 2 feet back towards the wall, because it's kind of in a corner. And normally, like, you can walk completely around the table, right, for ease of use and things like that, and there you have to like inch your way by. There's like 6 inches of space between like the wall and the chairs, and it's like that table has hands down, you don't hear a thing. But it's completely shifted, and you can tell by the position that it's in now, closer to the wall. So really weird stuff like that, that, you know, sometimes, as I say, I'm not even in the space and this stuff will happen, but it's always in that state of allowing, you know, you're letting your brain go. It's really cool. So to sum all this up, you've been talking about this documentary. Let's hear about this, because I know people are going to want to watch this. I can't wait to see this thing. Cursed Waters. Let's hear about it.
Well, yeah, and it's funny how Cursed Waters happened, because I originally was going to write the Ogopogo book. We had a contract with Beyond the Fray Publishing. My colleague Peter and I had written three books for them, and we had one more to write. And so I decided to write a book on Ogopogo, because Peter wasn't in a place where he could assist in writing a book. And so I started researching it and lining up interviews. And at the same time, Eli Watson, who works with Small Town Monsters, reached out to me, and he says that the whole team was coming up to British Columbia in May of that year. They were going to film On the Trail of Bigfoot, The Origin, in Harrison Hot Springs. But Eli had a few days where he could go off and kind of do what he wanted, and he decided he wanted to do something on Ogopogo because he's fascinated with the story. And he asked me if I wanted to go with him and help, and I'm like, heck yeah. I want to do that. And it was originally supposed to be for his YouTube series, Mysteries and Monsters. So we went out and we shot the documentary. We did the whole thing in like 2.5 days. And then met up with Seth and everyone else in Harrison Hot Springs. I did an interview for the On the Trail of Bigfoot, The Origin, and went off. And I finished the book. And the book had changed a lot. And it wasn't so many of the stories, like just scary Ogopogo encounters. It became more about, like we'd already talked about, like the culture of misappropriation and the filming of this documentary, etc. And so Beyond the Fray wasn't interested in that anymore. So I got out of the contract with that, and Small Town Monsters picked up the book. And then suddenly, Mysteries and Monsters wasn't going to happen, and it was going to be Cursed Waters. They decided to take this and make it into this documentary, Cursed Waters. And so it's basically exploring everything we've kind of talked about, going into it thinking we're doing something on this sort of flesh and blood lake monster, hearing the indigenous side of things, finding out there's much more of a spiritual component, and, you know, how the tourism Kelowna took this sort of very spiritual being and turned it into this marketing tourism thing. It became very much about conservation and preservation of the lake, not only for people, you know, like, you know, because of the pollution that's going on, but because there's something in there that's important. I think even the province of British Columbia recognizes Ogopogo as an endangered species, and it's protected environmentally. So that's kind of, the documentaries became less about this scary lake monster and more about this spiritual being that has a greater importance, which is awesome. And it's going to be coming out later this year. It's premiering at Monster Fest 2 in Canton, Ohio, at the end of June. And Monster Fest is June 29th, but it's supposed to screen at the Canton Palace Theater the night before. And then it'll be available on VOD platforms and DVD and Blu-ray.
Are you going to go to the screenings?
Oh, heck yes, I am. I'm going to be going to that. And the book comes out at the same time. Actually, from what I understand, they're going to be releasing it almost simultaneously. So hopefully at Monster Fest too. So I'll be there for the book. And the book is called, I believe the title now is The Legend of Ogopogo, Canada's Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, that sounds so fun. I'm so chuffed for you.
Thank you. I was very excited when all this kind of, the way that it all kind of came, and we're talking about, you know, like synchronicity, like the way it all kind of came together was pretty wild. But to have sort of the book, a supplement material to this documentary, that what I've seen of it is really, really good. It's sort of in the late stages of editing right now and narration. And it's going to be a really good documentary that I hope people like, as long as they're willing to go into it, not wanting just a bunch of scary lake monster stories, because neither the documentary nor the book are about that.
Well, that's what, like, Mike and I have been trying to avoid too with this show, is the fact that this is so much bigger than what people think it is, or they maybe have a sense that it's bigger, but they don't know how or why. And I love the approach that you're taking with this, because it adds to a broader discussion, which is that of consciousness. What is it? How do we fit into this? And what are these things that we're seeing? You know, is this something, you know, if this is something that is projected by us, then that's incredible. If this is something that's, you know, outside of us, that's incredible. You know, opening all these questions up, I think, again, makes us look back at us and go, you know, what is it that, how are we in interacting with our environment, and how are we perceiving what it is that our environment has to offer us. And I think I'm so excited for you and this documentary because this is a conversation that I think is going to be the next level of paranormal conversation. It has to be.
Mm. I agree 100%, 100%. And that's why it was really a nice surprise for both Eli and I to kind of find that we went on this path with the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, I really hope that people respond to it that way because I believe that that's exactly what's going on. I mean, I think, and I like how you sort of bring that up too, Morgan, like is this something that's there? Or is it something that we're manifesting kind of because we've heard these stories and the legends tied into it? I think that's a really interesting, the parapsychological approach too, right?
Where is that line? If there is one, you know, I don't even know if there is one anymore, that it's like, you know, where do these things start and stop? You were mentioning this idea of this water spirit that goes probably beyond humans, right? Beyond the existence of us, I mean, everything that we see and touch and experience was thought at one point. Well, then, you know, who's doing the thinking, right? Like it just opens up this incredible conversation, which is the conversation that I love to have about this. And I think that looking at these creatures, whether it be Ogopogo or, you know, Loch Ness or Dogman or anything like that, in this brand new way, it really forces us to do the inner work, which I mean, a lot of people, that scares the hell out of them. And it's, I think, easier for them to, like we said, but at the beginning of this, label it as evil or demon or whatever, but because it does make us self-reflect on what does this mean? If I'm experiencing this, what does this mean for me? Which is ultimately, I think it is about that expansion and consciousness. And Jason, I just thank you so much for coming on today and talking about this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, you guys. This has been amazing.
Where can they find our wonderful people? Where can they find more info about you and all the amazing work you have been doing?
You can find me, I mean, on Facebook and Instagram. On Instagram, it's Jason Hewlett Official, because there's another Jason Hewlett out there that's a motivational speaker. So you got to be kind of careful about that. And then, of course, we have our Canadian Paranormal Society page on Facebook as well as CanadianParanormalSociety.ca, where you can kind of keep up with what we're doing.
Well, that's exciting. Well, I hope everybody goes and clicks on that and joins it, because this is the next level of conversation that we need to have about this. So I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. Mike, what do you think?
I think it's awesome, and I'm just joining the group right now.
Excellent. Perfect. Thank you very much. there's a lot of also funny paranormal memes up on there too for people who are into that.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. This has been amazing.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
What a great conversation with Jason. I had not actually talked to him prior to our interview, and I really, really liked him. He's a really personable guy. I mean, he's still a journalist. I don't want to call him a former journalist because he's still doing that kind of thing.
He is. And I love the take and understanding that he has on this story, because I really think that this is where the discussion about not only lake monsters and Ogopogo and things like that are going, but this is where science in general is going. It is leaning now towards trying to understand the non-physical aspects of this world, and that it's not all about woo-woo thinking.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I kind of hate that term woo-woo now. You know, the more I learn and the deeper I go into these subjects, I kind of don't like woo-woo anymore, because there's something there. There's something going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to dig into a few things. I have some ideas of my own for some really interesting research that we'll present here on this show at some point. But let's just say we're going to dive in a big way. So...
Yeah, absolutely. And the more this can get on the table, I think the more empowered people will feel around this subject matter as well. You know, one of the things, I've got a you know, brand new show that's going to be coming out next October called My Haunted Hometown. And that, the whole idea, every time I do a show appearance, I want people to at least take away the experience that this is something that we have control of in terms of our perception, our emotional state, and that the paranormal is something that we are directly involved in. You know, and I think, and I love how Jason really pulls on that, is that this is about the idea that our perception plays such a massive role in what we are experiencing day to day, not just about lake monsters, but day to day.
We have a big hand in creating our own reality.
Huge, absolutely huge. And what a wonderful thing that is, and what a horrible thing that is all at the same time.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I've got this amazing, powerful mind that will work regardless of how I use it.
Yeah, and well, and it makes us accountable for how we use it. You know, I think that's what's so important about this. And that's why I'm really, really passionate about parapsychology, is that it really does make you accountable for how you're thinking. And as soon as you delve into this subject matter, whether it be, you know, Ogopogo, or whether it be a haunting or anything like that, it really does come back to the person every single time. And it takes the victimness out of it.
I mean, this isn't a new idea, really.
No.
James Allen's self-help book, for example, in 1903 was called As a Man Thinketh. Of course, it, now it would be updated to As a Person Thinketh. But, you know, and it all comes actually from the Book of Proverbs in the Bible, not to wax too far down that road. But, you know, these ideas that we create our own reality are as old as humanity itself.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, especially with, you look back on some of the older works, and you can really start to see exactly that. Like, we really did have it right early on. And I think that some of those ideas were kind of chucked as, you know, materialism became a greater factor in how science was explaining the world. And now it's kind of coming full circle. It's coming back to this idea that, you know, our experiences and what we're allowing and projecting, and it's kind of this very interesting cyclical phenomenon that we've got going. And I mean, I think the sky's the limit, you know, once science as science continues to embrace it.
Exactly. Well, there you go. This is such a big topic.
But I love it. It's so
Me
good.
Me too. It's why I'm. That's why we do this show.
Absolutely. And
thank you for joining us on this eerie, strange, mind-opening expedition, dear listeners.
And remember, the line between the natural and the supernatural is often a thin one, if there is one at all. Until next time, stay curious, friends.
Supernatural Circumstances is a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can learn more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and learn more about me, Mike Brown, and listen to my show, Dark Poutine, at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.